Today's Teisho will be on case 45 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 45 is entitled Hoen's Who Is He? Hoen of Tozon said, "Even Shakya and Maitreya are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he?" Mumon's comment, if you really see this another with perfect clarity, it's like encountering your own father at a crossroads. Why should you ask whether you recognize him or not? Mumon's verse, "Don't draw another's bow, don't ride another's horse, don't discuss another's faults, don't explore another's affairs." I want to thank everybody for coming to practice this morning. On this beautiful autumn morning, you know, last night when we finished the sit, we were walking outside, and I don't know if you noticed, it's not a full moon, but the moon was quite large over the horizon. It was really quite impressive. And this morning, driving here, there was a slight mist, and the leaves are sunlight was just coming up over the horizon and catching the trees, and very beautiful. So thank you so much for getting up this morning on a Saturday and coming here to practice. You know, there is a person who has been sitting with our group for more than a year. And periodically he will take me aside and he'll say after the sit, "Can I talk to you?" And I'll say, "Sure." And he'll say, "How can I improve my sitting?" And I'll say, "You have to do more sitting." And he always looks so disappointed. I think he's waiting for me to give him special instructions. And I always just say, "Look, you know, the secret to sitting is more sitting. You know, if you want to improve your sitting, you have to do more of it." And so I've invited him to come more often, and I've invited him to come on Saturday. I'm still waiting. It's possible to practice. I think that this person is quite typical. I think there are lots and lots of people involved in meditation who practice a certain way. And that works like this. You know, you're in a hectic life. It's a very stressful world. It just is. It's unbelievably stressful. You know, I just read something the other day. It said the average half of all Americans make less than $30,000 a year. These are people who, it's half of all Americans make less than $30,000 a year. And there was a time in my life when $30,000 seemed like a huge amount of money. But that was about 40 years ago. I think it was worth a lot more. And I didn't have a house bill, house payments, water bill, heating bill. $30,000 seemed like a fortune. But I thought, you know, it would be very difficult to live in New Jersey on $30,000 a year. And I thought, you know, I imagine many people lie awake at night and they're just terrified, right? It's like if your son or daughter gets sick, what are you going to do? Or, you know, you might have to leave bills unpaid, so you're paying this bill this month, and then somebody else comes after you, and then you have to pay that bill next month, and then somebody else comes after, you know. So, you know, a lot of people live under very, very difficult circumstances. I understand that. And a lot of people have very difficult lives in other ways. You know, they're in unpleasant work environments. And they go to work every day, and it's punishment. You know, I have a friend of mine. She's she just retired, and I would see her so often, and she would just have the most unhappy face. It was just, that was where she was. You know, how are you? She'd say, "Oh, I'm okay," and you'd look at her face, and it was just absolutely. It was like the blood had drained out of her face. And every time I would, you know, I saw her a couple of days ago. She came to a party for somebody in our department who was getting retired. And it was almost a different person. I mean, her face was so lively, her eyes were so bright, and she was so happy. So this is somebody who had been going to work for at least a decade, unhappy every day in her job. You know, so... And I know other people, too, who have real challenges in their lives. Basically, health challenges, you know, that's very difficult to deal with. You know, people can cope pretty well if the challenges are external. But when your own body is in trouble, when your own body is falling apart, that's very frightening. So I understand, that people have very difficult lives, you know. People in my own family, my sister works as an oncology ward. And, you know, she told me last time I saw her that she was really thinking of finally getting out of oncology because... she said it's just so draining to deal with people who are dying all the time. She said people die all the time in my workplace, you know. And she said it's getting to me after like 20 some years of doing this. So when people practice Zen, you know, you sit down on the cushion, and at first it might not help much, you know. You sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, and at first it might not help much. But eventually, if you keep practicing, you begin to get into this place that's really a relief. It's really like liberation almost. So, you know, you come into the Zendo and you're chased by your ghosts. You know, your boss is yelling at you, unpaid bills. If you learn how to sit, it's absolutely wonderful. I mean, I would say it has gotten me through my life, you know. You know, being able to just sit down, quiet down, and if you practice this for just a couple months with regularity, with faithfulness, when you sit down on the cushion, you will have a relaxation response about 15 or 20 minutes in. And, for some people, this is the only time they get to that place, you know. It's when they sit down on the cushion. And so it's so wonderful that the cushion is there, right? You know, so I think meditation has really caught on in America because we do live very challenging lives. And, you know, if you practice meditation just for a little bit, for like a couple months, and you really train yourself. You train yourself to sit. You train yourself to focus on the breath. You know, with great regularity, you will get to a place where you feel better. It may not be in the sit itself. Sometimes you sit down, and 15 minutes in, you just feel, oh, this is wonderful. That happens. Sometimes there's a lot going on in your head, right? The whole sit. But when you get off the cushion, you feel better. I used to have so many sits like that. When I was younger, I would go to the Zen Center in Seattle. I would sit down on the cushion, and about 3 minutes into my sit, it happened like with regularity, I would think to myself, what the hell am I doing here? You know, I have so much to do. You know, I have papers to grade. I have to finish this paper I have to write. You know, and I would just think of all the things I hadn't done. And I had, it was all I could do not to just get up and leave the zendo. I've got to take care of this other stuff. But, you know, I didn't do it. I would just sit there because everybody else was sitting there. I didn't want to bother them. I'd come all this way. And then it would be like clockwork. After like about 10 or 15 minutes, I think, oh, thank God I came here. I feel so much better. That wasn't so important. There's plenty of hours. There are many hours in a day. I can grade my papers. I can get my lessons ready, my teaching ready for the week. You know, and so, you know, at the end of the sit, even though during the whole sitting period, my mind was filled with distressful thoughts, you know, when I got off the cushion, I would feel cleansed, better anyway. And this is really wonderful, wonderful that such a thing exists. It's vastly superior to getting drunk or to drinking. It is. I mean, that's how most Americans, you know, if you're on this path, you forget. You know, that's how most Americans cope with their stress. We have record high levels of alcohol abuse in the United States, and that's true for college students, too. You know, so it's a very stressful environment, and basically a lot of people turn to alcohol. And sitting is so much better for you than alcohol. And of course, you might not have known this, but you know, actually the whole Northeast has a big heroin problem. And it's definitely the case that poor people use drugs because they're under so much stress and they have no way to deal with their stress. That's definitely why, if you investigate, that's definitely what's going on, right? You know, So basically, being able to cope with stress in a non-destructive way, in a way that makes you psychologically healthier, and actually in a way that's free, right? You know, is really wonderful. So this idea of training yourself to enter deep relaxation, to calm the mind and focus on the breath, is wonderful, and I hope everybody does that. I wish everybody in America did that. The world would definitely be a better place. In India, they have taken meditation practice into the prisons, mindfulness meditation, and it's been hugely successful. Recidivism, or returning to prison, goes way down. Violence in the prison goes way down. So this simple tool is so helpful. Just sitting on the cushion, calming down, getting some control over your thoughts, bringing your mind back to the present moment is hugely healing and helpful. But that is not everything, right? That's not everything. So, you know, it's possible to sit just for that. And that is perfectly okay. But, you know, when that young man came to see me after his sit and he said, "What can I do to deepen my practice?" He was there. You know, he's been practicing for a year. He comes to sit. He gets control over his mind. He feels much better. He tells me again and again how much better he feels. And then he gets up and he leaves the zendo, and he comes back the next week, and he said, "How can I deepen my practice?" And it's a very good question. You know, if you just practice in that way, you will have better mental health, and you'll have a better life, and that in itself is worth a great deal. But it's a little bit like taking an ibuprofen when you have pain in your body, right? You know, it does take away the pain, but it's not necessarily helping you to identify the source of your pain or respond to your pain, to the cause of your pain. So meditating on the cushion until you can reach samadhi and a sense of release is an incredibly valuable and precious resource for your life. But there's a possibility, really, that just doing that is a little bit like taking an ibuprofen, instead of really understanding the causes of your pain, right? Maybe you've torn a ligament. Maybe you have some other kind of injury to your body, you know. If you don't inquire, you just have more pain. So meditation is very much like this in Zen. You know, the assumption is that step one is being able to reach samadhi, and that in itself is a great achievement, and being able to get into a mentally healthier place. But then, you know, a part of meditation practice is learning how to encounter our obstacles, the sources of our suffering. And that is something people might be more reluctant to do sometimes, right? First of all, it does require more sitting. It requires more practice. And in Zen, we have something called koans. So koans are, you could think of them as subconscious or cues, or cues to your unconscious. And when people work with koans, they're gradually encountering their inner obstacles. And so, working on a koan, many people completely misunderstand what koans are. You know, if you read books on Zen, people talk about koans in rather mysterious ways, and it's always in the context of some kind of enlightenment experience, like a kensho. Kensho! You know, it's like we all have fantasies about what enlightenment might be like. Enlightenment is real, but it's not what sometimes people imagine it to be, not because it's not wonderful and amazing, but because it's not a mere miraculous event. You know, in the West, we have a tradition of miraculous events, you know, in our religious tradition. So, in olden times, people believed that a special person could make the sun stand still during a battle by holding up his arms, right? And then this kind of idea that miracles happen when, like, there's a divine intervention is very strong in Western culture. You know, so when we think about enlightenment, we kind of think of it as like a divine intervention or divine event, like a miracle. But it's more, it really isn't like that, you know. Working with koans is about going deep into our obstacles, going deep into our minds and encountering our obstacles and working through those obstacles. And this is difficult. It takes a lot of sitting, and it takes a willingness sometimes to be quite uncomfortable on the cushion. You know, so when people are working with a koan, sometimes they can feel very uncomfortable, and maybe angry, maybe fearful. You know, and you might think, well, this is not helping me. This is making things worse. And you might want to go back to that samadhi state, that very pleasant samadhi state, where you did feel better, you know. But in a way, koan practice is a much deeper engagement. You're really closing in on your obstacles, you know, closing in on your obstacles. And so it can be uncomfortable, can be difficult, and it definitely takes some hard work. But, you know, you should realize that this is going somewhere, right? This is not, this is really taking you somewhere. It's confronting your obstacles. You know, it's hard for us to know what our obstacles are. We don't really know what they are. Generally speaking, we conceal our obstacles from ourselves. You know, you see this sometimes in Zen practice where people will be come into the Zendo and they're so nice, they're smiling, very happy people. But you know, then in the context of like Dokusan, where people are coming in and speaking privately, you might realize that somebody who on the surface seems so happy and so friendly is just full of anger. You know, this is very common, you know, very common. And it's, in a way, you know, it's a surprise to the person. Because, you know, we often keep away from our own awareness the things that we are most afraid of, you know. So sometimes in Zen practice, you know, in the course of a sesshin, let's say, you know, somebody will come into the Dokusan room and all this anger will come out. And the person for all intents and purposes is a very sweet-natured, happy person. But here's where does this anger come from? Well, it's in there. It's been hidden away, and probably the person himself was kind of unaware of it. If you said to such a person, you know, you're an angry person, they'd be dumbfounded. What are you talking about? I have the sunniest disposition I know. But under the surface, there's this obstacle, see? And so koans are designed to help you encounter and work through your obstacle, okay? Your obstacles, okay. So this koan is called Hoen's Who Is He? Hoen of Tozon said, even Shakyamuni, even the Buddha and Maitreya are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he? Who is he? So this koan is really saying there is something, somebody, even more important, even bigger than the Buddha, even bigger, more important than Maitreya, who is the future Buddha, who is going to come someday after the present Dharma age is over. So this koan is saying there's something even bigger than the Buddha. What is it? Now, you know, if you try to solve the koan intellectually, you can sit down and think it through, but it's perfectly useless to try to do that. What you really have to do is enter deep samadhi and then internalize a key phrase, or it's called the turning phrase. So there's usually in the story a little phrase that you can put on the tip of your breath as your breath goes out, and you can keep repeating it. So who is he? Or even just who is this koan? And if you begin to work with the koan, you know, it's quite possible you will encounter in yourself obstacles you never knew were there. You know, sometimes it's possible to answer a koan, so-called answer a koan, fairly quickly. So if you're working with a koan, I might give it to you, and without even knowing why, you might come in and say something to me. And I might say, oh, that's a wonderful answer. And you might not know why it's a wonderful answer, but you're glad to pass the koan. And as your reward, I'll give you another koan. And this koan might take a year to answer. You know, the last koan took 3 days to answer. Why? Well, the one that takes you longer to answer is probably coming to a place in yourself that you don't want to open up. See? So it's koans that are easily answered, you know, usually means that the person doesn't have a lot of investment in this issue. Yeah? So I'm not trying to discourage you if you've been answering your koans easily. But it doesn't necessarily... It's good, congratulations, you know. But sometimes the koans that take longer to solve are the ones that get closer to the... that cut closer to the bone, right? Closer to the bone. And so, you know, we don't necessarily want to open that door in ourselves and face that. So, you know, we work very hard to keep it closed. Keep it closed. And so, you know, a lot of Zen practice is people coming into Zen, into Dokusan, and after sitting, for many hours, And the teacher's job is to try to get them to open the door, or to stop holding it closed, really. Because really, that's what's really happening, is the person's holding the door closed. So you can encourage them, you can reassure them. It's a long process. It takes a lot of work on the student's part until they find the courage or find the desire to open the door and see what's behind it. So this koan is asking something really, I think, really important question, and really a big question. Who is he? Who is he? You know, in a way, it's also asking you, who are you? Who are you? So this is like a fundamental, this is a big koan. Who are you? You know, there's a certain person who's never heard of Zen, and who would just be astonished that this was a koan. You know, if you ask a certain person, who are you? They'll say, I'm Ted Smith. You know, next question. And it might seem to that person so obvious that he's Ted Smith. Who else would I be? Right? I'm Ted Smith. So, you know, that kind of person, it seems absolutely dead certain that he's Ted Smith. And there couldn't be confusion about that. But if you think about it, you know, Ted Smith is actually not your real self. Or Kurt Spellmeyer, or whatever you call yourself. You know, if you think about it just a little bit, you know, when you're a kid, you know, you learn to answer to your name, right? You know, my brother's name was Peter. But my father had an uncle whose name was, they used to call him Beck, B-E-C-K, Beck. And my father used to call my brother, instead of calling him Peter, he'd call him Beck after his uncle, because he looked like my father's uncle. So he'd say, Beck, come here. And so my brother grew up, even though his legal name was Peter, being called Beck. And my brother, when he was very little, didn't know any better. Okay, he's Beck, right? But when he got to school, it was like a terrible event for him. Because, of course, Becky is a girl's name. Right? So when my brother first went to school, and they said, what's your name? And he said, Beck. Everybody's eyes got big. Beck, you mean like Becky? Becky? My brother, you know, I'm sure he wanted to drop down into the bowels of the earth, you know. And he was deeply depressed, really like deeply upset by this, you know. You might know this, but some little boys are very troubled about little girls. You know, like little boys, they don't want to be around little girls. They don't want to be touched by little girls. They don't want to do anything that appears to be what a little girl would do. My brother and I were sort of opposites. You know, I actually, when I was a little kid, I had a lot of girlfriends. And I liked hanging out with them, you know. And so I had no trouble sort of being around, especially there was a very nice older girl in our neighborhood. She was probably 10 when I was 6 or something. But she thought I was a cute little kid, and she'd come over and play with me. And I was so happy to have a friend. And we could play at dinner, and we'd have little drink out of little teacups. And I didn't mind at all. But my brother was a different kind of boy. He had like toy guns. Any kind of any contamination by the feminine was mortifying for him. So anyway, being called Becky caused him incredible distress. He would actually cry in his bed, you know. And finally, my father would say, come on, my Uncle Beck, why, he was the toughest guy in Newark, you know, or something like that. But finally, my brother begged my, please call me Peter. Pete. So he went from being Beck to Peter. Right? It's a big crisis. You know, we learn to occupy a name. We learn to not occupy a name, but it's really not who we are. It's just a name someone gave us. You can't really say that fundamentally I'm a Kurt. You know, that would be crazy, right? You know, when I first read a book by Kurt Vonnegut, I was so happy that there was a famous Kurt, you know, because when I was growing up, nobody had the name Kurt, you know, so this was wonderful. Kurt Vonnegut, you know, I'm a Kurt too, you know. But I'm not fundamentally a Kurt or fundamentally a Susan, you know. This is something we learn. We're something before we were Kurt, and we learned to sort of like put on the Kurt shirt or the Susan shirt, right? And go around as though this were our true self, right? And this process goes on all of our lives, right? You know, so when I meet new students at college, I work with freshmen. You know, some nowadays, lots of students come here already with a career path in mind. But in the old days, you used to meet a lot of students who were just exploring. You'd say, "What do you want to major in?" They say, "Oh, I don't know yet." And, you know, "I don't know yet." So you know, they would take an anthropology course or an art history course or an economics course, and it's all exciting, you know. But eventually, you know, if you become like an English major, you know, you stop taking those other courses because you don't have time. You have to get your 35 credits in. So you take fewer of the other courses, and you take mostly English courses. And then maybe you go to graduate school. And, you know, you stop reading anthropology or economics or science, and you pretty much read English literature all the time. You know, when you go to graduate school, you have to read all this criticism. And, you know you're in graduate school when you go home for Thanksgiving and your family says, "Well, so what are you writing your dissertation on?" And when you say it, nobody understands what you're talking about. You've really arrived, right? You've become a real academic when your research is so arcane that nobody knows what the heck you're doing. That's not your fault. It's like you're drawn into a world, right? It's like there's a world of like a literary scholarship. And you're a free agent, and you get sort of sucked into this, and pretty soon this becomes who you are. Right? I'm a literary critic. And not just I'm a deconstructionist. Well, I'm a Marxist critic, right? I don't like deconstructionists. You know, I don't like them. I'm a Marxist, you know? So it gets like that, right? So you cut it finer and finer. And, you know, and there are people in English who are known as the Marxist critics. And then there are the deconstructionist critics, and they have conferences where they sit on a panel and shoot at each other across the table. And you know, it becomes who you are. But remember who you were before you were Peter, before you were Dr. So-and-so, remember you were something before any of these things. And they lure, you know, you were assigned, you put on the Susan dress or the Kurt shirt, and they lured you into English literature or psychology, and that became sort of who you are. But it's not who you really are. It's not. You know, the problem is, you know, I think basically people are very open fundamentally. You know, little kids are capable of identifying with their surroundings often very easily. You know, you'll see little kids at play, and their self is very porous, right? Very porous. So like after a movie, they're all imitating the movie like crazy, right? They'll be imitating a character in the movie, you know, or they'll get very excited about their surroundings. You know, so I think we have this capacity. We know in a certain way that we're this very fluid. We're like water, right? Very fluid, very transparent. The self is very fluid, very transparent. But as we grow up, we gradually get trapped in these identities that we can't get out of, right? And they're accompanying mental habits, right? Accompanying mental habits. So the classic cases of this are people who when I was young, I mentioned earlier that I used to like to play with the girls. I had a woman named Carrie Morrissey. And another woman named Joyce, they both thought I was really a cute little kid. So they would come over to my house and ask my mother if they could borrow me. And they would we would walk around the block together, and they thought I was funny and cute, right? And they would sometimes they would take me out and get me an ice cream cone. It was a great deal for me, you know. And sometimes Carrie's sister Lynn Ann and I would sit, and she would make dinner in her little oven, her little play oven, and it didn't really bother me very much. But when I got older, it bothered my father a lot. So at one point, I wanted I watched a movie, Pinocchio, and Pinocchio was a puppet on strings, like a marionette. And I wanted a marionette so badly. But, they didn't make marionettes in the United States when I was growing up. Or you couldn't find one to save your life in Baltimore. Yeah, they might have them in other cities, but not in Baltimore. So I wanted my mother to buy me a doll. And my mother just was so torn up. She said, "A doll? What do you want with a doll?" Right? So anyway, I remember my father being very worried about he wants a doll. They were discussing it in the bathroom. This is really serious, And I remember my father, when I was about 13, he bought me a football outfit. And he said, "You are a red-blooded American boy." Right? So he wanted me to be a red-blooded, whatever that means, a red-blooded American boy who loves football. To this day, by the way, I have never seen a football game. Never. I've never sat through one. I've never done it. I don't like football. I hate to say it, but the thing is that people try to make you something. And let's face it, my parents were afraid I was going to be gay. Right? They were terrified of this. Right? And why is this a problem? But people kill themselves because they're gay, right? So we get trapped in identities that often societies forces us to play a certain kind of role, and it's not where we want to be, but we think we should play that role, and we get tremendously wrapped up. Tremendously tied up in knots, we feel we should be Kurt. We feel we should be a red-blooded American boy. We feel we should be something, and then you could have these incredible inner conflicts. I have encountered people in the world of Zen who are clearly living out their parents' dreams for them. And they hate what they do for a living. This is quite common. They've done studies of doctors, like doctors. And my mother wanted me to be a doctor so badly. Was in love with a doctor in our community. I don't think they had an affair, but I definitely think she was incredibly, she wanted me to be like this doctor. And she would say, "If you could just be a medical man, like Dr. Pittman, you could be like Pittman, your life would be wonderful." So I think all over the United States there have been mothers who have said to their children, you must be like Dr. Pittman, you know. And for better or worse, I didn't do it. But a lot of people do it, and the studies show that lots of doctors are very unhappy with their lives. You know, they don't like to go into their jobs. You know, they have a double rate of depression, actually, and substance abuse. So lots of people are living out the dreams of their parents, right? And, you know, it's very difficult not to live out those dreams because you've gotten so much love for doing what your parents say. You know, but when you're living a life that is not the life you want to live, it generates many, many destructive behaviors. You know, a lot of violence against a self, a lot of anger issues, you know, even like sadism. All of these things are caused by, this problem of trying to inhabit an identity we don't want to inhabit, right? So, you know, a lot of Zen practice is not just about getting a buzz on in samadhi, right? Or releasing our tension. You know, we have a bigger fish to fry, right? You know, we are all to some extent prisoners of these roles that were created for us long before we arrived on the earth, you know? And we become so unhappy sometimes because we can't be the role. It's so uncongenial. It's so unpleasant. And we're so afraid, you know, of, say, not being loved, that it's very difficult for us to defy our parents and be something else, you know? And it doesn't have to be our parents. It, we look to other people, other authority figures, as though they were real when we are not, see? So, when I started graduate school, when I got to Rutgers, I noticed that a lot of graduate students in our department had a strange accent. They all sounded like they were from New England. And I thought, gee, we must be recruiting a lot of graduate students. I would hear these graduate students say, the word is modern, M-O-R-D-E-R-N. And I would hear these graduate students saying, the modern, like somebody from Boston, the modern, that's the modern. And they had other intonations, and I thought, where is this coming from? Well, then I met one of the very senior professors in our department. It was a man who's now deceased, named Richard Poirier. And Richard Poirier was from New England, and he used to say the modern. So all of these graduate students would come to Rutgers and study with Richard Poirier, and pretty soon they were picking up his speech patterns, and they'd talk about the modern. Like Poira. Poira. Now, what's going on there? You could be mad at them. You know, you could say, what phonies? You know, say modern. You know, but it's more complicated than that, right? Because, you know, they see him as real. That, you know, they feel like imposters. Their graduate students are pretending to be literary critics. He's a really real literary critic. He's the real self they want to become. See, but Poirier's no more real than they are. See, this is very difficult to let go. You know, we create these idealized images, and we believe they're real, even though we don't feel real in our own skin, so to speak. But maybe it's not real. You know, and we fight. We keep pushing away this sense that this is not real. This is not real. I can't permit myself to think that way. Because if I do, I won't be the great literary critic I want to be. And if I'm not the great literary critic, then I'm nobody. See, this is terrifying. But actually, we are nobody. See, we are nobody. And this is heaven. Heaven. See, But we don't want to go there. Because we have what Buddhism calls upside down views. The state of being, which is the most open and flexible state, is the one we sometimes fear the most, because we're trying to hammer ourselves into a narrow slot that we think will make us real. See? And so every time we're haunted by a sense of our own unreality, every time we feel like we're an imposter in these roles, we try to repress our freedom and put another layer of chains around ourselves. You know, we all want to be Richard Poirier in English. We all want to say, so we say Maudlin. And if we say it enough, maybe we'll almost be Poirier. See, I have a friend who studied with one of the great. There's a guy. He actually is a Marxist critic. And he is so prolific, he must just write day and night. Because every time you pick up some journal, he's in there. It's like, does this guy ever sleep? You know? And he just seems to pour, the language just seems to pour out. Well, I have a friend of mine who was his protege. And my friend has written 2 books. This guy has written like 25 books. And my friend feels so awful because he hasn't written 25 books. Sometimes he feels so like he's been such a letdown, you know, to his protege. Because his protege, it just seems like, tosses off a book every 6 months, you know. And this guy has to work for years and years to write a book. And, you know, I think my friend has gone through a lot of unhappiness, you know. Because he hasn't been able to be so-and-so, right? And this is a classic trap. This is like a classic trap. You know, I tell him, 50 years from now, the great literary critic, nobody's even going to know his name, right? They won't. You know, who were the great literary critics of 1930? Nobody knows, right? In their day, everybody wanted to be so-and-so. Now nobody even knows who they are. So why eat your heart out, you know? But it's very hard for people to free themselves. And by the way, one good book is all it takes, right? To have a big impact, you know, on society. You don't need 25. But you can't reason people out of their traps, right? That's why something like Zazen is necessary. You know, we sit down on the cushion and we discover this fluid, porous, water-like mind that we really are. You know, this mirror-like mind. We have this extraordinary capacity to change and grow. We are really like amoebas, you know, really. Like, you know, we can change our form again and again whenever we are in a different situation, but we don't think we can, because we get locked into one identity, right? One identity. You know, in Zen, there's this. We practice a kind of Zen called Linji Zen, Rinzai Zen. And Master Linji was he made this phrase, the person of no rank. You are fundamentally a person of no rank. See, you have to understand, in Chinese society at Linji's time, everybody had a rank. The emperor had a certain kind of dragon on his shirt, and if you had that dragon, they'd chop your head off. Really. You weren't only the emperor could have this particular dragon design on his shirt. See, only the emperor could wear yellow. You know, until the 20th century, Buddhist monks in China, Zen monks, didn't wear yellow. They wore black because yellow was the imperial color. Now they wear yellow, but they used to wear black because you weren't permitted to wear yellow. So, you know, there was a color for every rank. There was a basically your clothes had a certain kind of insignias on them, indicating your rank. If you were a peasant, basically you were at the bottom, and that was most people. So most people in China, especially educated people, felt like crap all the time. Because they felt like losers. You know, if you had failed the imperial exam, you were a washout. And if you passed, but you weren't a top administrator, you were a loser too. You know, so everybody went around feeling like losers. They all felt inferior. And Lin Ji said, who cares about this? Who cares about the emperor's shirt? You are a person of no rank. Inside you, Lin Ji said, there is this amoeba. You're fundamentally like water. Water can flow anywhere. It can adapt itself to anything. It's transparent. Light flows through it. No obstacle can hold it back. See, that's your true nature. It's like water. You know, how wonderful. See, and of course, no water, no life, right? So, this is, discovering our true nature is not easy. You know, we have, when somebody tears the mask off, we just put, there's another mask under it, you know? A lot of Zen training is like, you take this mask off, but there's another. You take this mask off, and there's another. You take this, finally you get through all the masks. You get to a point where you're out of masks, right? And this seems, for many people, this feels like the worst thing in the world that can happen. But it's actually the most wonderful thing in the world that can happen. Hoan of Tozan said, even the Buddha and Maitreya are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he? Mumon's comment, if you can see this another with perfect clarity, or she said, if you can be this another, with perfect clarity. It is like encountering your own father at a crossroads. Why should you ask whether you recognize him or not? Don't worry about fitting the role. Right? Don't worry about fitting the role. Mumon's verse. Don't draw another's bow. Don't ride another's horse. Don't discuss another's faults. Don't explore another's affairs. Be the water.